is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Monday, October 14th. I'm Sarah Ling, filling in for Buster Olney, who's on his way back to New York for tomorrow's Game 3 of the ALCS between the Astros and the Yankees. He'll actually join us later in the podcast. Second time he'll be a guest on his own podcast. But first, let's take a look at the magic that happened on Friday night.
The 0-1. Swing and a liner center field, but right at Taylor. He's there. He makes the catch. And that is the inning. On pitch number 75, Aníbal Sanchez, 6 no-hit innings, and the Nationals lead the Cardinals 1-0 in game 1 as we head to the 7th.
And Aníbal Sanchez was cruising through 6. He cruised through 7 as well with a no-hitter before it was broken up in the 8th by Jose Martinez, a pinch hitter. And Sanchez became the first pitcher in postseason history with multiple starts of 6 innings or more with one or fewer hits allowed. And we'll have more on that a little later. And that was Bouchambi on the call with Jess Mendoza and producer Justin Ware for ESPN Radio on the NLCS. After the game, Aníbal talked to ESPN's Pedro Gomez.
Aníbal, you threw a no-hitter in 2006, but you were a rookie. What does this outing, what does it mean to you?
A lot, especially because I put the first win for the team in this series. We're playing against St. Louis. It's no easy team to face. It's no easy team like to give anything kind of opportunity. And right now, we got the win. We got the first win. That's the more important thing right now.
Obviously, a lot of people, they talk about Scherzer, Strasburg, Corbin, and you're kind of like the next one.
That's good at the end. That's good. They don't pay too much attention to me, and I just try to do my job and help the team every time that I got the ball.
After the game, Nationals manager Dave Martinez addressed Sanchez's outing.
He had great tempo, good rhythm, but he pounded the zone. I mean, in, out, used all his pitches effectively. I mean, Aníbal's been, he's a big part of why we're here too. I mean, he's pitched unbelievable since coming off the IL, so he's a big part of our success. Man, he goes out there and he gives us a chance to win every time he's out there.
And he did, and they did just that, taking game 1 of the NLCS in St. Louis. Let's move to Saturday. Next night, it was basically deja vu. Max Scherzer instead of Aníbal Sanchez, but he's on the mound cruising through 6 innings.
Fowler at first, 1-0 Nats, the pitch. Check swing tapper, that's it towards third. Loved by Rendon, slings to first, inning over. 6 no-hit innings fired by Max Scherzer, and the offensive woes continue for the Cardinals.
And Max, again, with a no-hit bid, he ended up pitching 6 no-hit innings. It was broken up by Paul Goldschmidt, a single in the 7th inning. And Scherzer joins Aníbal Sanchez as the only pitchers with multiple 6-inning, 1-hit or fewer outings in the postseason. They're the only guys in history, and they both got their second such start in games 1 and 2 of this NLCS. Later in the game, though, it was early. It was tight. The Nationals led 1-0 on an early Michael A. Taylor home run, but then Adam Eaton stepped to the plate in the 8th inning.
3-2 to count. The pitch. Swing and a ground ball. Fair ball inside the first baseline and down the line it goes off the sidewall. In to score is Adams. Here comes Turner to the plate. He dives across. It's a 2-run double for Adam Eaton. And the Nationals now lead it 3-0 as he pulled that one just fair inside the first base bag.
Some insurance runs for the Nationals that would end up being pretty important. Later in the game in the 9th inning, Patrick Corbin came in. In the 9th, got Colton Wong to start the inning, and then it was Daniel Hudson on for the final 2 outs.
The Nationals win it here in game 2, 3-1 the final. And the Nats have gone on the road and taken the first 2 of this NLCS.
With all of their playoff troubles, all of their playoff history, the Nationals of all teams up 2-0 on the road in the NLCS, as Boog said. After the game, Max Scherzer was talking to Pedro Gomez.
Max, you watched Aníbal Sanchez last night. You and I spoke about him yesterday, actually. What, if anything, did you learn from watching him? I know you're a different kind of pitcher.
Just change speeds. There really wasn't too much today. It was a little different because we had the shadows and working to my advantage. And that was, kind of working with it. Hey, make sure you're spinning the ball. It's a little tough to pick up right now. And so that's where, just want to trust Zook, what he can do back there. We work so well together on how to sequence guys together and, just go out there and just compete.
20 innings this postseason, ERA under 2, only 5 hits allowed. What is going on with you?
After the wild card game, really found like I found my arm slot and my glove positioning and where my hands need to be at. And so from there, I've just been able to get in rhythm with Zouk and just execute pitches.
I mean, is that simple?
It's not simple. It's complicated. Everything, every little thing matters within your mechanics. So one little thing can take things off and one little thing can put you back on track.
How do you guys stop from being overconfident, being up 2-0 on the road going home?
We grind. We know how good they are. We know that they compete as hard as anybody in this league. So just because where the series is at doesn't mean anything. We still got to compete just as hard as they do.
Always fun to hear Max Scherzer talk about Anibal Sanchez, what he's learned from him, something he's been talking about since they were teammates back on the Tigers. Dave Martinez, after the game, talked about Max Scherzer's performance.
He was dynamite. I mean, his stuff was good. His changeup was really good today. Utilized it well. Fastball was good. He was locating his fastball early in the count. So he was good. You know, the conversation was not as hard as I expected. He said he was pretty much at his limit. And I figured that at about 100 pitches or so, he'd be good. And, you know, we get through the seventh inning and we have Huddy and do by conversation today. I knew we need to get an out from Corbin or two. He was available.
And he also talked about his team being up 2-0.
Hey, we're going home, playing in front of our home fans. It's kind of nice going back, up 2-0 in the series, but, you know, those guys are really good over there. I mean, the series is far from over. We got a day off tomorrow. We're going to spend the night, get a good rest, and work out tomorrow for a little while, and then get back at it the next day. You know, we got Strauss on the mound, so hopefully he comes out and gives us what he can, and hopefully he does what Sanchez and Scherzer did, you know, the last two games. But, we still got a long way to go. My message after the game was still, hey, 1-0 every day.
Mike Schilt, Cardinals manager, talked after the game about how the Nationals have held his team in check so far.
Can't ignore the fact we've been shut down pretty much for two games in a row. We won't make excuses for it. There's a lot of variables to it, you know, but the reality is we haven't been able to get it done. As far as adjustments go, you have guys that have been getting pretty good, some pitches to hit, not a lot of them. There's not been a lot of pitches to feast on.
And he echoed something that his opposing manager, Dave Martinez, said, too.
I mean, this series is far from over. And we have a guy going that's one of the best guys and really the best guy in baseball. Second half, undisputed, going for us on Monday. Like I said, I'm very optimistic still about this series.
That series continues tonight, Game 3 at 7:38 p.m. It'll be Jess Mendoza and Boog Shambi on the call on ESPN Radio. Over to the American League side, we saw the ALCS get underway on Saturday night. Quite the night for Gleyber Torres.
One on, one out, no score, top four. Gleyber Torres, first pitch swinging, line drive to left center, and this ball will get to the fence on a couple of bounces. LeMahieu easily in to score. Gleyber Torres with an RBI double, and it's the first run here in this series as the Yankees now have a 1-0 lead in the top of the fourth. Here is Gleyber Torres, first pitch swinging, and no matter what baseball they're using, this one is going to go. Torres with a fly ball into the Crawford boxes in left. He has driven in both runs tonight, now with a double and a homer, and the Yankees lead 2-0. Presley has his sign, 3-2 on the way, and a swing and a fly ball off the end of the bat, shallow right center field, and dropping for a base hit. Two runs will score on the play. Judge around to third. The ball loose in the infield. Torres accelerates into second. He's driven in 4 runs tonight, and the Yankees lead 5-0.
That's Dan Shulman on the call for ESPN Radio with Chris Singleton and producer Beth Faber. And what a night for Gleyber Torres. He became the third youngest player with 5 RBI in a postseason game, and he's now tied for the second most extra base hits by any player under the age of 23 in a single postseason. Extra base hits, that should be.
Deep center field.
The game.
It's gone!
Of the day.
Our game of the day, of course, the ALCS game from last night, the Astros against the Yankees in game 2 of the ALCS. The series was the Yankees were leading 1-0 heading into game 2. Carlos Correa stepped up to the plate against James Paxton in a nothing-nothing game in the second.
The set and the 2-0 on the way, and a curveball grounded past a diving Urshela down into the left field corner. Bregman is going to score. Alvarez will be held at third. It's an RBI double for Correa, and it is 1-0 Houston.
That's Correa's 26th career postseason RBI, which tied Lance Berkman for most in Astros postseason history, and there'll be more on that later. Now, later in the game, Aaron Judge came up to the plate in the fourth inning against Justin Verlander, down a run.
Next pitch to Judge is hit a long way to deep right center. Mariznick racing to back, and this ball is gone. A line drive home run over the wall in right center. Judge connects, and the Yankees have a 2-1 lead.
That was a 110.9 mile an hour exit velocity on that home run, which is the hardest hit home run Verlander allowed all year in the regular season and postseason combined. Later in the game, a quick hook for James Paxton in the fifth inning, and Adam Ottavino came on to face George Springer.
As Ottavino comes set, Sanchez slides to the outside, and the first pitch, a slider and a hanger, hit a long way, left field, it is gone! George Springer hits it out to tie the game.
Springer's 12th career postseason home run, which broke a tie with his current teammate, Jose Altuve, for most in Astros postseason history. In the top of the next inning, DJ LeMahieu tried to head home on a Brett Gardner single.
There they go, and the 3-2 is swinging, a one-hopper off the body of Altuve, bounces to Correa. Runner coming home, the throw, the tag, they got him. Correa alertly getting to the loose ball and fired a strike to the plate to get LeMahieu by several feet. And that will retire the Yankees with the game still tied.
An 87-mile-an-hour throw from Carlos Correa, who had the second-highest average arm strength among all infielders in 2019. Game stayed tied at 2, thanks to that play and others, until Correa himself came to the plate to lead off the bottom of the 11th.
And Carlos Correa steps in. Jay Happ is the pitcher, and the first pitch hits a deep right field. Judge back. It's gone! Carlos Correa walks it off. And the Astros take game 2 to even up the series at a win apiece.
That was Correa's second career walk-off hit in the playoffs, making him one of just 7 players with multiple walk-off hits in the postseason. Correa talked to Buster after the game.
Carlos, describe the feeling when the ball left your bat.
And it was gone off the bat. I've been successful against him going the other way. I was looking for something down the middle that I could drive the other way, and he threw a good pitch to do that.
What was the journey like around the bases?
It was great, man. It was great. So much adrenaline. I don't even know what I did. I just know I had a lot of adrenaline pumping, and I just enjoyed it.
What was it like to play in this game?
It was a crazy game. You know, JB did an outstanding job, but I think the MVPs of this game is the bullpen. Our bullpen was nasty today. They kept us in the game and gave us a chance to win the game.
Correa and David Ortiz are the only players with multiple walk-off hits against a single team, and both have done that against the Yankees. AJ Hinch said after the game, the team knew just how important this game was.
This is all about tonight. This team, you know, obviously we heard the talk in the last 24 hours. We got punched in the face yesterday. The Yankees came in, and then they take the lead. Judge hits a ball to the, you know, Torchies in center field, and you know, and all that comes with playoff baseball. I mean, this was an incredible game of coming back, and our bullpen stepped up, did an incredible job. JV set a great tone. We had big swings. We had a ton of opportunities. We lined out a lot that even in those opportunities. So just really proud of how our guys stay in the moment.
He also talked about the team not getting ahead of themselves with the series tied 1-1.
It's hard to say what it's like to go through it because we're in the second round of a 7-round fight, or what could be a 7-round fight. So, you know, obviously we know what's at stake. I mean, that's the emotion's real out there, the intensity, the, you know, our fans were incredible. These 2 games, we're going into a crazy environment, Yankee Stadium, and, you know, tied 1-1. So I'll let you know at the end of the series how it feels.
Justin Verlander talked after the game about just how special this moment was.
I mean, I think it's taken years off my life, that's for sure. I think every championship run, when you look back, at least from my experience. There's always moments throughout the course of a ball game or series, or you know, how did we win that game? What happened? And I mean, I think tonight's nothing short of that.
And Aaron Judge talked about what went wrong for the Yankees.
Had quite a few chances to score, guys, and we just weren't able to get the job done. You know, that's what it comes down to, is, you know, just a lot of missed opportunities. You know, I think back to, I think DJ singled off Verlander, and I got a pitch right down the middle and, you know, hit it to the track. You know, that can't happen. You know, I got to deliver right there, and yeah, just missed opportunities.
That series continues Tuesday afternoon, 4 o'clock at Yankee Stadium with, Dan Schulman, Chris Singleton, and of course Buster on the call for ESPN Radio. Exciting show coming up today. And before we speak with Buster, Troy, can you tell us about something that's making your life easier this fall?
Of course I can, Sarah. So this fall, you can start a new monthly routine that'll upgrade your life and style with a box of awesome from our friends at Bespoke Post. Bespoke Post sends guys only the best stuff every month. So whether you're looking to craft your own hard cider or toast perfectly aged fall cocktails, I don't know if you're a cider girl, Sarah, but I'm a huge cider guy. So Box of Awesome has you covered, from style and grooming goods to barware, cooking tools, outdoor gear. Box of Awesome has carefully built collections for every part of your life. I was looking at some of the fall options they've got. I'm a big coffee guy, and they have this awesome roast box that has a cool French press, a coffee grinder, Anchor, dark roast coffee grounds, really cool. They still offer the Refresh Box, which I got this summer. Has a peppermint bar of soap I use it every day, cool shampoo, conditioner, toothpaste that I take on the road in one of the bags that they give you. There's some construction paste put in your hair. I'm actually wearing it right now, and I'm feeling good. So to get started, take the quiz at boxofawesome.com to see which box works for you. Your answers will help them pick the right box of awesome for you. They release new boxes every month across a ton of different categories. It's free to sign up, and you can skip a month or cancel anytime. Each box costs only $45, but has over $70 worth of gear inside. So get 20% off your first monthly box when you sign up at boxofawesome.com and enter the code BBTN at checkout. That's boxofawesome.com, code BBTN, for 20% off your first box. All right, here's Buster.
I'm thrilled to be joined now by Buster Olney, whose podcast, of course, this is. Second time that Buster is a guest on his own podcast, and I'm honored to have been the host both times. Buster, thanks so much for joining me.
Sure, Sarah, thanks for filling in. Crazy travel day. Baggage claim Monday would have been even too much for today, because I got like a 40-minute layover here in Detroit on my way home.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we'll be sure to get some baseball talk in for you during that layover, which is the only thing to do during a layover. So, obviously, we've already mentioned you're with the ALCS right now with the radio crew. What was it like on the field for that career home run and the aftermath?
It was, you know, it was interesting because he, of course, Carlos has had some struggles this year. And when he drove in his first run early in the game, after he got the hit, he looked into the Astros dugout and he started pumping his fist. So you got to feel like Carlos was, you can tell, almost like trying to work himself up a little bit, you know, given the struggles that he had. And so when he hit that ball in the 11th inning, my eyes immediately, I didn't follow the ball, I followed him. And so when he put his hand to his ear, kind of like, you know, the Grinch in The Grinch Who Stole Christmas, put his hand to his ear and looked at his own dugout, that was classic. I love that right off the bat because he knew it was gone. And then he makes that, you know, trip around the bases. And the next time I saw Carlos, he'd had his jersey ripped off by his teammates. I saw his helmet go in the air. Yeah, they were going crazy. You knew going into this game, the Astros understood that this was basically a game that they absolutely had to have. They did not want to go into Yankee Stadium down 0-2.
Definitely. And you really felt like, I mean, even just watching on TV and listening to you guys on the radio, I really felt the energy that Correa specifically brought that day. I mean, even going back to the play where he threw out LeMahieu and he did the little Dikembe Mutombo finger wag, you know, it was like this was the Carlos Correa game, which was so exciting to see, especially knowing all that he did go through or what is out there of what he went through this season and with his injuries and all of that. What was the mood like in the Yankees clubhouse after?
It surprised me how down they were. Look, I mean, they, you know, of course, had an opportunity to go ahead 2-0. But you figure, you know, over the course of a long season, the players are used to having a disappointing defeat. But, you know, you go into the clubhouse, and the only thing that you could really hear or the sound of the clubhouse attendants brushing the dirt out of the players' spikes. The players are saying nothing. And then, you know, when Aaron Judge and Brett Gardner and others were asked the question about, you know, how disappointing was it, they were like, yeah, it was tough. And they felt like, you know, that time after time after time, they came to the with an opportunity to take control of that game, and they missed those opportunities. And they could have left Houston 2-0 if as Judge said, if he had gotten a hit there, or if Gary Sanchez had come through at some point, or if they had scored a run against one of the Houston relievers that came in later. So, yeah, it was surprising how down they were after that game last night. But I'm sure they'll be fine by the time they get to Game 3, and they'll be at home. But let's face it, to get one game against either Verlander or Gerrit Cole could be absolutely pivotal in this series.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like they have to. They will have to beat those guys, at least one of them once, in order to find a way to win the series. So, you know, they'll still have some other chances for sure, but you can see how maybe it's a little bit demoralizing when they rely on their bullpen so much, and it has been so good for them. But it's just really hard when you get into those deep games like that. So kind of leading into that, what's going to have to happen for each of these teams moving forward in order to win the series? What do you think the kind of X factors are?
Yeah, it felt like last night, because we've talked so much about the Yankee bullpen, and rightly so, but it almost was like the Astros bullpen drew a line in the sand. Like, you know what, we can be pretty good too. You know, whether it's Will Harris with the job that he did, you know, I thought Josh James was terrific in the spot that he was brought into. All the guys who came in later, they all responded in that effort. And so as they move forward after a day off, you know, both bullpens will be rested and ready to go. But I think for the Astros, a lot of confidence in that. And let's face it, if you're the Yankees now, Game 4, you, in theory, would have an advantage because that looks like it's going to be more of a bullpen game. They're going to face Zach Greinke in Game 5. Greinke, who didn't necessarily look great the other day. To me, you know, if you're the Yankees, I mean, boy, Game 3 is one you almost have to have. Because you do not want to go back to Houston, you know, where you're in a situation where you're down 3-2 or even needing a win. Like, they need to do as much damage in New York as possible, given the fact that they would face a Verlander in a Game 6 and a Gerrit Cole in Game 7. And it'll be interesting to see how their offense responds, especially in my eyes, Gary Sanchez, who his at-bats early in that game last night were just awful. And then by the end of the game, when he had that long at-bat in which he fouled off a number of pitches and eventually somehow convinced the umpire that he fouled the pitch off and then extended the at-bat, and the umpire maybe realizing that he'd messed up and sort of doing a makeup call on a pitch that was about 4 inches outside, you felt like Sanchez's at-bats were getting better as that game went along. And at some point, you know, they're going to need him to step up.
Yeah, and I was looking at what he and Edwin Encarnacion have done so far in the just recent games for them. They both need to kind of figure that out, and I think that's going to be huge for them, especially at Yankee Stadium, where obviously we know, especially Edwin, has played very well. Another thing that kind of occurred to me with the, you know, just moving forward, I mean, if you look at the weather forecast, and obviously we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but it's supposed to rain all day on Wednesday. Who do you think would benefit more if it were rained out? And obviously we have no idea. I don't know what it would take for there to be a rain out, but it does look like it's going to pour all day.
Yeah, and that would definitely be an issue. And by the way, I, you know, last night during the broadcast, they started talking about that on Wednesday's weather. And so I've gotten to know Jim Cantore of the Weather Channel a little bit. I actually just found out 5 days ago he's a fellow Vermonter, which was cool. He graduated from a high school 20 miles from where I grew up. I had no idea. But Jim said that it looks like it's going to be a steady rain. It's possible that it'll clear out by 9 o'clock. But it is going to be a lot of rain on Wednesday. And then I checked with baseball's premier meteorologist, Mike Trout, who sent a note back, and he goes, it looks like there could be an inch of rain. Doesn't look good. So, yeah, that could be a factor. And I feel like, I don't know how you feel, but I feel like that the more compressed the series is, meaning that teams play more games back-to-back-to-back, that would erode some of the Yankees' theoretical bullpen advantage. Because I think the Yankees are set up well if they have days off built into the series. You know, if you have that day off between Game 5 and 6. On the other hand, if they have to go day after day after day after day, and Aaron Boone you know, manages aggressively the way that he did in game two by pulling James Paxton out in the third inning, that takes some of that away. What do you think?
Yeah, no, definitely. I was thinking as the game was going on last night, I mean, they tied a postseason record with 9 pitchers used. And, you know, for context, the Red Sox and Dodgers used 9 pitchers in the 18-inning game. This was an 11-inning game. And I know he said postgame he can't manage as if it's going to go 13 or something like that. But it's very hard to do that when you're not hitting into an off day. And I would imagine that when you get into a potential situation where game four gets moved a day and game five and all of a sudden your travel day is messed up and all of these other things, that that does not bode well for a team that does have to rely so much on its bullpen, even though the bullpen has been so good. And speaking of the bullpen, you know, it was really fun to see CeCe Sabathia come in last night. You know, I wasn't there, but everything that people were saying on Twitter about as he was coming in for the game, that it was a lot of fun that he actually went into a jog. They didn't show it on the broadcast, so I will have to take your word for it there. But what do you think about him being the left-handed one-out guy for them there? And is this, you know, going to continue?
Yeah, it was funny. I talked to CeCe on Friday, and I asked him about his bullpen routine and how he felt about that. And he goes, you know, I don't have it down. And then I talked to him again before yesterday's game. And I said, you know, how are you feeling about your routine? He said, I got it. I'm down to 11 pitches. I can warm up in 11 pitches. And he was good, and he had that big grin. You know, I love the line that he gave after the game, that what almost killed him was that jog in from the bullpen, like that he has to do. Look, there was some criticism of Boone, Aaron managing his bullpen aggressively last night. He's trying to win the game. Like, yeah. I think for both teams yesterday, you know, it was of utmost importance to try to win that day's game. And as he was aggressively using his bullpen, if the Yankees get a run in the seventh or the eighth or the ninth inning, then the strategy looks exactly right. And so for him to aggressively use those relievers and try to give them and put up zeros and try to give them a chance, yes, in the end, that's how come he winds up having to rely on Jay Happ. But I agree with Aaron. I think that made sense all along. You're just trying to get through each inning. That was the thing you needed to do last night.
Yeah, for sure. And, I mean, there was some, you know, amount of criticism of even when he removed Paxton. But, I mean, I honestly thought in the moment that was the right move. And sometimes the right move is just you're also facing a great hitter. You know, George Springer's a really good hitter, and this is what can happen. I don't think that any criticism of when he removed Paxton was really warranted. What do you think?
Sarah, well, and here's the thing, too, and I, you know, didn't get a chance to go into the Astros clubhouse after the game, but it was clear from the body language and the conversations that were going on the Astros side, they had Paxton. And he was, in terms of, you know, he was tipping his pitches, using his glove or using his hands, or there was something, because even Paxton began to, you know, make his adjustments by wriggling his fingers more consistently in his glove between pitches. And Paxton is not a great matchup against the Astros because he's a left-hander. They know him from all those years in Seattle, and it's such a predominantly right-handed hitting lineup. I just being there, and you assume that once the traffic began, that Boone would begin to make moves aggressive with his bullpen because his bullpen was rested and because they have the off day today. Thought it made absolutely all the sense in the world, especially, again, I'm sure Aaron, Paxton, Gary Sanchez, they're all seeing the swings and the adjustments made by the Houston hitters, and they know that the Astros are tracking Paxton early in that game.
Yeah, for sure. I just wanted to have that out there, and I figured you would think the same. That's not how postseason baseball works. You don't leave James Paxton in that situation. That's just not what we've seen over the last few years. One other thing coming out of that game, or coming out of the series, was obviously Giancarlo Stanton's quad injury, which he suffered in game one and was revealed before the game yesterday when he wasn't in the lineup. What level of concern do you think the Yankees have going forward, and is there anything else on that?
I don't think it's a big level of concern. I didn't see Stanton in the clubhouse after the game. I wondered if part of it was, you know, Stanton telling them, I'm a little bit sore, and the Yankees kind of using that almost as an opportunity to take a hitter out who wasn't a great matchup for Verlander. You know, in his career against Verlander, 1-for-8 with 5 strikeouts. As you know, Sarah, you know, Stanton struggles at times against super high velocity, and that's what Justin Verlander is, and he could hit the top of the zone. So I kind of wonder if it was a combination of You know, he's not feeling great, and it's not a great matchup. So let's get him out. Let's put him to the side. You know, they made it clear before the game that in an emergency situation or in a pinch hitting role, he would have been available. And let's face it, if it was a big deal, they could always take him off the roster. You know, Luke Voit was there, bumped into him after the game. They could put him on the roster if they thought that Stanton was incapacitated in any way.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see what continues with that going forward and whether he does start in game three. So one other piece of news from the weekend, an Outside the Lines report, a public relations employee for the Los Angeles Angels told federal investigators that he provided oxycodone to pitcher Tyler Skaggs and abused the drug with him for years. Sources familiar with the investigations told Outside the Lines. Eric Kay, the team's director of communications, also gave U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration agents the names of five players he believed were using opiates while with the team. Skaggs, 27, died July 1st in a Texas hotel room from choking on his own vomit. An autopsy found evidence of fentanyl, oxycodone, and alcohol in his system. Kay told authorities he gave Skaggs oxycodone days before the team left for Texas, but does not think they were the pills that Skaggs took before he died. Buster, what does this OTL investigation mean moving forward?
Well, one thing for sure, Sarah, we've seen this time and time and time again, that Major League Baseball will plow in the wake of a federal investigation. They will pick up threads, and they will follow up, and they will have conversations. I'm assuming that at some point they're going to have access to those five names of the players deal with those players and investigate those players. You know, the best example of that was the Mitchell report, where so much of the information there came through the work of federal investigators, and I would expect baseball will do that. And they'll have conversations to, you know, with the folks involved, that Eric Kay said he spoke to within the Angels organization. And look, there's no doubt that this case, I think, is going to be used as a cautionary tale by, front office officials in talking with players and talking with their own employees, you know, telling their own employees, look, you can't ever put yourself in a position where you're providing any kind of medication to players illicitly under the table. And I think it'll give an opportunity to tell players, too, that if you approach club employees for medication, then we're going to have to report this because of how this played out, especially in the tragic manner in which Tyler Skaggs lost his life.
All right, Buster, thank you so much for joining me, and go catch that next flight.
I do it, absolutely, Sarah. And thanks for helping out this morning.
Of course, thank you.
Steamheads rejoice.
Nerd alert!
It's Timmy time.
Is this a great game or what?
With Tim Kirchen on Baseball Tonight.
I'm honored to be joined now by Tim Kirchen, ESPN MLB Insider. Tim, thank you so much for being on this morning to chat.
My pleasure, Sarah. Combined weight, you and me, probably 250 pounds. How about that? Combined weight.
That might be a record. We might have to have Troy and Josh go through some record books from the podcast and see what we can do. Last time, we had a record with Buster being a guest for the first time on his own podcast, so maybe we have a weight record now. Speaking of some people, though, who are a lot bigger than us, Jack Flaherty on the mound tonight for the Cardinals. In D.C., down 2-0, is he exactly the guy that the Cardinals want pitching this game, even before the series starts? Obviously, they're not hoping to be down 2-0 or anything like that, but is this exactly the situation that they want, given what's gone on?
Yes, Sarah. He was the best pitcher in the National League the second half of the season. He had an ERA under 1, and all you have to do is watch him pitch, and you can tell from 1,000 miles away the presence that he has on the mound. It is unmistakable. And then when you hear him talk before the start, you know this is a guy completely in command of what he's trying to do. I told you he was a teammate of Max Fried's in high school and Lucas Giolito. So Giolito got hurt his senior year, and Jack Flaherty replaced Giolito in the rotation. And Max Fried told me, he said, so this guy comes up as a sophomore and becomes the greatest high school pitcher I've ever seen. And we all knew right away this guy was going to fit right in. That's how good Jack Flaherty was as a sophomore in high school. And now that same presence and that same command we see on the major league level. And boy, do the Cardinals need him today, because obviously this is a must-win situation. But they have not just the best pitcher on their team going, but a guy who's basically been the best pitcher in the National League for the last 2 or 3 months.
Definitely, and they're going to need every ounce of that. I think it's been so much fun just to see his maturity on display in the playoffs this postseason. I mean, you know, I was watching, you were watching, we're all watching him during the regular season, but to see it on this stage, to see what he's done, even in the start where he gave up the runs to the Braves and all of that, he's just shown to be so in charge, you know, which is what you're referring to. And I've absolutely loved to see it, but he's got to face Steven Strasburg, and Steven Strasburg has been so good in this postseason. I think he's, you know, with Steven Strasburg, it goes back to when they shut him down when he could have pitched in the playoffs that first time around. And, you know, his legacy has always been sort of an interesting one. And I think it's been really cool to see him sort of shift that legacy. And I think that if the Nationals can advance here, that he's certainly going to change that and how we remember him 10 years from now. But can the Cardinals jump all over him? I mean, we've seen them fail to get a hit until at least the sixth or seventh inning in these first few games.
Right. Well, the Cardinals had their hands full again. Sarah, as you know, through his first four postseason starts, Steven Strasburg had an ERA under one with 34 strikeouts in his first four postseason starts. No one in Major League history ever had an ERA that low with that many strikeouts through his first four starts. And his last start, which was his fifth, was pretty darn good also. He is so much more mature as a guy and as a pitcher than he was, say, when they chose not to throw him in and shut him down several years ago. He's a different guy. He is a more joyful guy and yet just the same intense competitor. But I don't know what the Cardinals are going to do with him tonight, but if this is more than a 3-2 game, I will be really surprised. That's how good Strasburg is. And, of course, that's how good Flaherty is.
Yeah, and we've seen that, you know, obviously Sean Doolittle gave up a run in Game 2. But for the most part, the Nationals have this bullpen kind of figured out. And I've absolutely loved watching this. I mean, this is one of those things that I feel like we're both kind of, you know, going over. I looked up something that they've had Corbin, Strasburg, and Scherzer pitch in relief for them, and they're the first team to even have two guys who had 200 strikeouts for them in the regular season pitch in the out of the bullpen for them in the same postseason, and they've had three guys do it. You know, it's not at all what you expect, and I didn't necessarily think it could work in a best of seven series, but so far it has for them. I mean, they're only two games in and they've gotten outstanding starting pitching, but can the Nationals really do this with this piecemeal bullpen where Sean Doolittle maybe isn't the most trusted and Daniel Hudson isn't the closer that they relied on all year, but he's there now and, you know, using the starters out of the bullpen? Can they continue to do this?
Well, it's worked so far, and this is out of necessity, Sarah, as you know. This is the highest bullpen ERA of any team to ever go to the playoffs. So Dave Martinez did not have, and still does not have, too much of a choice in certain situations. They got to win, and the best way to do it is the way they've done it. Now, the key question is, can you do this starting from the wild card game through the World Series? Usually, you only get in a panic state late in an LCS. The Nationals have done it from day one of the playoffs. So that's the key question. I think it can work because of the people involved. Corbin is a really young, strong guy. Max Scherzer, of course, is on a different level when it comes to a competitive nature. And Strasburg has proven, which I didn't see coming, a real versatility and ability to bounce back after, you know, some difficult spots and come back on short rest or whatever it takes.
Yeah, it's been so much fun to watch. I remember even just watching the NL wildcard game thinking there's no way they can keep doing this. Like, this is cool. This is great. Okay, Strasburg's coming in now, but we're not going to see this 2 weeks from now. And yet, you know, here we are. So I think it's really, really incredible. And it's so much fun to see things that haven't happened. And we could see the Nationals in the World Series. I'm not trying to get ahead of myself. Obviously, the Cardinals were a great team all year, and they could very easily come back and tie this series up. But no team to go down 2-0 at home in an LCS has won. The only comebacks that we've seen when the road team won the first two games were in the World Series. So, you know, we'll see what can happen. But what would it mean if we could actually see this Nationals team even get to the World Series? Don't even get too far ahead in the idea that they could win it, but just even getting there.
Right. Well, I grew up there, as you know, Sarah, and I'm kind of amused that we talk about the Nationals in conjunction with the Expos, and obviously they came from Montreal. But I think the better comparison is to look at baseball in Washington over the years. I mean, when I was a kid growing up, the team was terrible. But it didn't matter because we had a major league team in our town in the 60s, and it was great. But the bottom line is, a Washington baseball team has not been to the World Series since 1933. They have not won the World Series since 1924 when Walter Johnson was on the team. I mean, and they haven't played any real meaningful games from 33 until they made the playoffs several years ago. So to me, that's the comparison, is just how long baseball in Washington has been away or suffered. And that's why the crowd tonight at Nationals Park will be unbelievable, because people will recognize what I'm talking about here. This is the biggest game played in the nation's capital since 1933.
Definitely. And we've seen, I mean, I thought that those crowds, even in the NLDS games, even at the wild card game, they looked so electric, and you could just even hear on TV, you know, how much energy there was. And I don't think that it's necessarily a town that you think of with baseball these days, for the reason that you said, because of the lack of success. So it's always fun to kind of see a fan base really get their footing and understand and be able to put all of their, you know, emotions behind a team. And I always thought it's cool at Nationals Park how they have retired numbers from the centers as well. To your point about sort of interacting with Washington baseball as opposed to with the Expos, they have the Expos ones too, I believe, and they have the little logos. But I always thought it was cool to see those older school, the old school W, that very boxy kind of W, and all of those numbers. But yeah, we'll see what happens tonight. But it's been a lot of fun to watch this NLCS, and it's always fun to see something that we really haven't seen in a while. Thank you so much for joining me, Tim.
Okay, Sarah, good luck with the podcast, and I'll see you at the World Series, if not before, okay?
Sounds good. Thank you so much, Tim.
See ya.
I'm honored to be joined now by Todd Radom, who runs the weekly quiz round here, of course, and is a graphic artist. You can see his work all across baseball fields and fields across America. You can also go to his website, toddradom.com. Todd, thank you so much for joining me.
Sarah, what a rare and wonderful opportunity to speak with you. This is great.
Yes, this is so much fun. Todd and I first got to chat in person when we did our live podcast back in 2018 in D.C. That was a lot of fun. He saw me looking nervous before I went up on stage, so here I am now, less nervous.
But that was great.
Yes, it was. So we've got the playoffs going on right now, but I'm here. We talk about the Mets a lot with me. So we were kind of going back and forth and thought that the Mets might be a good thing to talk about here. Obviously, their logo is pretty notable and interesting, how it came to be and their color scheme and everything else. Todd, what do you got?
Yeah, so in thinking about this, Sarah, okay, the Mets are, I'm sorry to say it, but long since cooked for the 2019 season. But the Mets look like the Mets. I mean, you know, which is a great thing. And the Mets, of course, wear the blue and orange, which are the official colors of the city of New York. They date back to the House of Orange, back in the back in the days of yore. So I thought it was a good opportunity to speak with you about, how do you feel about the state of the Mets headwear, and at any time were you a proponent of the Mets wearing black caps?
Okay, so I was always very anti the black uniforms, caps, all of that. It's not one of the team colors. I understand a lot of teams use white, you know, for backgrounds of jerseys, obviously, for obvious reasons, even though it's not a team color. But black did not seem necessarily worth introducing. But it is worth noting that a lot of, I believe that they were those, you know, in 99, 2000, 2001, when there was, yeah, you know, some team success. So I understand maybe some nostalgia for it, but personally, I always loved, like when I was growing up, when I was a kid and I had a Mets hat, the most Mets hats were those black Mets hats, but I loved the blue hat with just the orange logo, like very classic. I thought of it as like 1986 and all that, and that was what I was on board with.
You are a classicist at heart, and I would agree with you. And I think there's something wonderful about the fact that, you know, I say this sometimes, you can, in this case, draw a direct line to Casey Stengel and Mark Thornberry and the sad Mets of 1962, straight through 1969 and Seaver, et cetera, to 86, like you just said, and right up to Pete Alonso, the present day. There's this wonderful continuity. The Mets, like I said, they look like the Mets. And I think it's kind of interesting when we talk about the Mets to note the fact that their NY was cribbed from the NY that the New York Giants wore before they departed for the West Coast in 1958.
Yeah. You know, growing up, I was actually just telling someone this the other day, though I can't remember the context at all. But you see at baseball games anywhere, but especially in New York, you'll see people in the orange and black NY, the kind of curly Q NY hat sometimes, you know, oh, a throwback, I'm cool, I'm wearing a New York Giants hat, whatever, however people think of themselves. And when I was little, I always thought those were just like miscolored Mets hats, you know, like very little before I learned. And my mother obviously is a Giants fan. I think I've talked about that a bunch on this podcast. So pretty early on, I did learn the orange and blue. Oh, the blue came from the Dodgers and all of that. But when I was little, I did think, like, what's wrong with that hat? Is it, was it in the sun too long? Like, how did it turn black? I thought that should be a blue hat. I didn't quite understand. So,
well, you know, with fashion caps, Spike Lee originated the red Yankees caps and all that.
Exactly.
So, you know, it was a pretty good guess. And, yeah, and kind of thinking about Mets, we kind of can segue right into something that we spoke about, you know, with Buster and Troy several weeks ago, and that would be the Washington Nationals W, which certainly does look like Walgreens, which we can touch on or not touch on, but where's the commonality between the Nats and the Mets? The Nats got their W from the old Washington Senators, managed by Ted Williams, in the district before they moved off to the Metroplex and became Troy's Texas Rangers.
Yeah. I think that's really cool. You know, I remember when that Nationals logo came out. So my association with the Nationals Walgreens looking logo is that, I'm not sure if you remember that when the Mets first announced Citi Field, they had this orange and blue kind of like rectangular logo that had Citi on it. And it looked just like the Domino's logo.
Yes.
Where, like, when you did side by side. So those two things I remember becoming things on Twitter or whatever else, like, around the same time. That, like, oh, this is the Walgreens W. I'm actually staring at a Walgreens bag right now, which I didn't realize until this exact second. It's like a Duane Reade by Walgreens. Anyway. And so there was, like, oh, the Nationals are the W from Walgreens, and the Mets have the Domino's logo. So I don't know. Honestly, that is a question I have for you. I mean, how do you continuously come up with new ideas of how things are supposed to work? Because I understand how that happens with the W and with that Domino's thing, because I don't understand how there are new things under the sun sometimes, especially with things like this.
Yeah, and, you know, it's hard to do things that are simple, and simple things are the best when it comes to sports logos. You look at, you know, some great, you know, the Yankees NY. I mean, yeah, it's got 100-plus years of equity. But simple is hard to do. Think about, like, some of the most, you know, the Toronto Maple Leafs. It's a blue maple leaf that says Toronto Maple Leafs within it. That's a hard thing to secure in terms of a trademark. But that's a whole other conversation that we can have another day. But anyway, let me say on the record that the Washington Nationals, to my knowledge, or the Washington Senators, used that W before Walgreens did. I'll have to double check that so I don't go off on a limb in a wrong direction. But yes, confusion there.
Yeah, definitely. But we will give the Senators credit for originating it. And maybe it was the, you know, the Walgreens who was doing something wrong and taking somebody's logo. But yeah, that's a lot of fun. All right, should we get to the quiz?
Let's do it. Here we go.
Cool.
So the Yankees and the Astros are matching up in the American League Championship Series for the second time in three seasons. Which one of the following has been the most common ALC matchup since its inception in 1969? Is it A, Yankees versus Royals, B, Yankees Red Sox, C, Athletics Red Sox, or D, Twins Orioles? The most common of the matchups across the boards in the ALCS all time, Yankees Royals, Yankees Red Sox, A's Red Sox, or Twins Orioles.
Okay, I'm going to let Troy go first.
Wow.
Because
no,
I know that's
no.
A thing.
This is a gentleman's podcast, ladies first.
I am new here. I am learning. This is my first time participating, so I would like Troy to go first.
Oh, man. Todd, that
I need to break the tie. Troy, you go first.
That's a tough one. The Orioles have never been good in my lifetime. The Twins haven't won anything. Literally have not won anything in the playoffs in my lifetime, I feel like. Yankees Red Sox was an option, and then Yankees who was another option?
Yankees Royals, Yankees Red Sox, A's Red Sox, or Twins Orioles.
Let's go with Yankees Royals.
Oh, boy. That's what I was going to say. Because every time I look up an LCS note, I feel like there's a different Yankees Royal series that I get to add a note on.
Well, everybody wins today because you're both right.
Oh,
it's
boy.
Yankees Royal.
Woo! Let's four. Go.
And, nice. And I'm going to show my age, which is much older than either of you, and tell you that I went to game one of the 1977 Yankees Royals ALCS. Cut school. My dad took me out of school. We went. It was a beautiful day and a great ALCS. So there you go.
That is a series where 200-win teams faced off, and the team with fewer wins won the series, which was notable for this series because it's 200-win teams, and the Yankees have the fewer of the 100 wins.
And this will be a great series that I suspect is going to go deep, and we got a 1-1 yes. tie. We'll see where we go.
All right. Well, this is a lot of fun. It was really great to talk to you, Todd. I really appreciate this, and I enjoy learning that I am staring at a Walgreens bag, and only on this podcast and only with you, and that is what is so wonderful about what you do. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much. What a pleasure, and I hope it's not the last time. Not that I don't like Buster or anything, but like I said, a great and rare opportunity to be here. Thanks so much.
Bleacher Tweets.
Hey, Sarah, our first round of Bleacher Tweets together. I'm excited. Let's get right to it. The first one comes from P.K. Steinberg at P.K. Steinberg, who wants to know, is Anibal Sanchez's pitching performance Friday night in St. Louis among the most improbable in postseason history?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think that Anibal Sanchez does not get enough credit. I think he's finally getting a lot of the credit that he deserves, but I think that overall, I mean, this is a guy who early in the season, there was an interview with Max Scherzer on Baseball Tonight, where he talked about how much he idolizes Anibal Sanchez and has tried to learn that Mariposa, his butterfly changeup, from him. So I think that in some ways, this question, we're underestimating Anibal a little bit. But I would say that was a team that just scored 10 runs in the first inning in a winner-take-all game. So from that standpoint, the fact that it was this Cardinals team, it's definitely pretty high up there on the list. But remember, he had a no-hit bid in the postseason before. So I do think we need to keep that in mind as well.
It's so crazy. I was listening to Game 2 on Saturday, and John Schamme dropped the note that the last time that a team had been no-hit through five innings in two consecutive days in the playoffs was the 2013 Red Sox, and the two pitchers to do that were Anibal Sanchez and Max Scherzer when they were with the Tigers. So just baseball,
yep.
Crazy. Next one comes from Joshua Brown at the Joshua Brown 1. Hey, Sarah, would the Nationals still be in the NLCS if they had Bryce Harper?
Oh, boy. So the one thing with this Nationals run is that this has become a little bit of a narrative, and I just don't think it's exactly fair. I mean, the Nationals, this is not the best Nationals team that we've seen even over the last 6, 8 years, whatever it's been, in all honesty. This is just the team that has been lucky enough to have the success, and they've earned it. Not that it's all been on luck, but it's just kind of one of those things where it's not always the best team that's the one that's advancing. I don't think it has anything to do with whether or not Bryce Harper is there. I think that, you know, from the national standpoint and from their fan standpoint, I think it's just great to see them be able to go out and have this success after losing him, after, you know, potentially hitting that kind of crossroads moment with the franchise and seeing guys like Juan Soto really come on and be in that role of helping carry the offense along with Anthony Rendon. And, you know, I'm sure that they might have been here, and we never know, and you never know how a season is going to play out, but I don't think that it has to do with his presence either way.
Next one from Damon Hughes at The Damon Hughes. Clayton Kershaw acknowledged his postseason struggles after Game 5, but how bad is his postseason history really? His failures have been memorable, but do his overall stats and records support the postseason narrative?
So, I appreciate this question, and, you know, this is a question that I think I would have answered a little bit differently, obviously, even just a couple of weeks ago. I mean, heading into this postseason, I was still kind of in the camp that, you know, to what Damon is saying here, you know, we remember the struggles, but he's really been okay, at least, but it's really hard. It's really hard after that performance in Game 5. I mean, he has a 5.77 ERA when his team is facing elimination in the postseason, and you know, it's almost to the point where even if the overall ERA isn't awful, I believe it's in the fours, it's the postseason. So the expectations are different too. You know, and it's just really hard, but it is mind-blowing. I mean, it is absolutely mind-blowing. If you look at Hall of Famers, you look at the really, really elite pitchers, which Kershaw is one of. He really is. None of them had postseason issues like this. You think about it, you're like, oh no, he must have had a bad start here or there. He must have whatever. Even guys who in the moment were seen to be a little bit struggling in the postseason, maybe guys like Andy Pettit who weren't there so much, when you look back on it, their numbers were not nearly on this kind of level.
Final one this morning comes from my girl, Debbie Gammons Brown, at D Gammons Brown, who wants to know, Sarah, what is your guess as to what eye color is listed on Max Scherzer's driver's license?
So I loved this tweet so much that I did a lot of research on it, and I think it is so much fun. So obviously, Max Scherzer is not the only person in America with heterochromia, the two different colored eyes. And there are some Quora links and other sorts of links where people say, hey, what does your driver's license say and whatever. So one of the examples that I saw was that it says DI, which is dichromia, which is like a synonym for heterochromia. So that could be a possibility. Apparently, there are ones that say other, O-T-H-R. And maybe says it somewhere else. And then there are some that have a slash mark with like blue/brown. So I do not know which of those would be on Max Scherzer's driver's license, but I would love for someone to ask him this one day because I would love to know.
Be a great post-game question in the playoffs.
Yeah,
thanks
right?
for the tweets this morning. Keep them coming every day. Buster will return tomorrow, so use the hashtag Bleacher Tweets.
And that's all for today. I just want to say thanks to Tim Kirkton, Buster Olney, and Todd Radom for joining me. Buster will be back tomorrow, but until then, thanks so much for listening and have a great day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.